ambiguity and reason locked in a slow, ferocious tango of if not, why not?
You could drive yourself absolutely balmy with that question, couldn't you? Perhaps that's the idea. Hello, you're just about to listen to me, Steve Wasserman, having a chat with Niall O'Sullivan, poet, raconteur, armchair philosopher, and absolutely amazing host of Poetry Unplugged, London's biggest, bestest poetry open mic night at Covent Garden's Poetry Cafe. It's on a Tuesday. If you've never been, you are officially missing out. Feel the FOMO. We kick things off by discussing the differences between being called a poet and being called a trumpet, and then move on to a little game of my own devising called Cryptic Countdown. We do actually get round to talking about an August Kleinshaler poem at some point too.
What I really love when you Google your name is that, you know, you're on Google, not on your website, but on Google, your name comes up, and then there's a dash, and then there's the word poet.
Yeah.
and there's something about that word. Mm-hmm. I'm interested what that word does for you, but there's something about that word next to someone's name, Niall O'Sullivan, poet, that sort of raises a wry smile. And I'm wondering why does it raise a wry smile? There's something kind of is it sort of kind of slightly old fashioned, rococo? What is it about that word poet?
Poet. I don't know. I only put poet there because there's another Niall O'Sullivan who plays the trumpet, and you get Niall O'Sullivan trumpet. So I don't play the trumpet. I'm a poet. I know what you mean. I sometimes like hold back, when I'm meeting a prospective landlord or something like that, and you know they go, "What do you do?" Oh, I'm a writer. I always end up saying, and a little something, you know, the cock crows three times and all that kind of stuff, you know, and I just feel like I've just become a Judas for my art form. But there's definite kind of situations where I tend to find myself the word poet kind of sticks in my throat, and I end up saying writer. Or something like that instead, but
why does the word poet stick? I was trying to think of other titles that would get that same wry smile from me. Like someone gave me a business card. Mm-hmm. If you gave me a business card and it had Niall O'Sullivan, landscape irrigation. Gardener.
Yeah.
No problem.
Yeah.
But Niall O'Sullivan, poet, and I was thinking, I came up with a few. Right, I thought, okay, Niall O'Sullivan, philosopher would do the same thing for me.
Yeah.
Niall O'Sullivan, quipster. Niall O'Sullivan, sage. What is it about that word poet that unnerves us somehow? We kind of want to titter almost.
I think it's because it's kind of like, I think we, a lot of people write poetry, but not many people call themselves poets. And we feel that if you call yourself a poet, then something has sanctioned you to call yourself a poet. You have crossed some particular line or achieved something. So a lot of people, it's always funny when someone will turn up at the open mic sometimes and say, "I'm a published poet," or something like that. And I wonder why they say that. And obviously the thing that people in my industry call themselves, no one does actually. People used to call themselves performance poets. And now I find that people who kind of are more into the live aspects of poetry will now call themselves poets, or they will be spoken word artists or something like that, and they'll leave the P word out completely. It's true, like it's a bit like someone calling themselves a philosopher. I mean, even people with degrees in philosophy don't call themselves philosopher. It's almost like the only person who sort of calls themselves a philosopher without any self-conscious twinges is Alain de Botton or something like that. I don't know. But it's just like and there's that thing, like I think it's a similar thing with poets. When do I start to call myself a poet?
And I think that is a good moment in which to head into I can't say this man's name. Kleinshaler. Maybe if you say it with an American accent. He is American. Kleinshaler. How do you say his name?
August Kleinshaler.
August Kleinshaler. August Kleinshaler territory. The Strange House Traveller's Keep, which you're going to read to us. I thought before you read it, there were a few words I actually looked up in this poem.
Okay.
Because you know those kind of words where you kind of go, yeah, I know what that means, and then someone says, what does that word mean? And you actually, I could not tell you what that, I sort of know what it means by context. So I thought we would do a very quick, just for the reader who is not sitting with the dictionary, a quick countdown round. I'll be Nick Hewer.
Do you know what? I really thought about looking these up before I came, and I didn't.
That's perfect.
And I know there's one word, which is a word I should know, and I've completely brain farted as to what it actually means. But yeah, I'm ready for
this. But you guess what it means.
Okay.
You guess what, and you know the poem. So
yeah.
I mean, let's face it, you could probably guess by context-wise.
Yeah.
And if you fail every single word, then we might just edit this out.
Okay. No, keep it in. In the spirit of the mundane comedy, my failures must be there for everyone to see and laugh at. Okay.
So the first question, I mean, they don't do this on Countdown, but I don't know why Countdown came to mind. So this is an easy one. This is an easy one. But I actually, this is one of those words which I think I know what they mean, but I couldn't give you the dictionary definition. So what are photons?
They're light particles.
Very good. Next one, a little bit more difficult. What is a Unisys A15J mainframe?
I didn't look this up at all. In fact, no, you know what?
Do you want to have a guess?
I reckon it is, from the sense of the poem, I assumed it was kind of one of these stock market screen type things that you read all the kind of current stocks and shares and all the information is displayed.
You're absolutely right. Unisys is a worldwide information technology company, and they do all the kind of the number crunching and put it all up on screens. And
cool. Yeah. I only got that from the logic of the poem. I honestly did not look that up.
What is a Thunderhead?
I don't know. Is that a jet? No.
Because it's next to passenger jets. Isn't
it? It's a Thunderhead. I'm guessing that's just like a sound of thunder or something, maybe.
A Thunderhead is a, I can't even read my own notes, a cumulonimbus cloud seen during a thunderstorm.
Ah, right, there we go. Okay.
What is a scow? Not scowl, scow.
Is that kind of boat or something?
Yeah. It's a sort of a barge.
Right.
Epistemologist?
So someone who studies knowledge.
Absolutely. Peristalsis?
Is it something converting sort of sugar to... I can't remember. I just remember the biology teacher I hated who used to always go, peristalsis, like that. But I'm guessing it's some kind of digestive kind of... I can't remember. Is it sugar?
It is to do with digestive. I love the definition that I got of this. Peristalsis is a series of wave-like muscle contractions that moves food to different processing stations in the digestive tract.
Right, okay, right, yeah, there we go.
So it's the muscles kind of going, sausage-like in the
making little
large intestines. I think that's pretty much it in terms of vocabulary that might slip people up. Great. So, do you want to do us a reading?
Yeah, sure. The Strange Hours Travellers Keep by August Kleinsaler. The markets never rest. Always they are somewhere in agitation. Pork bellies, titanium, winter wheat, electromagnetic ether peppered with photons, treasure spewing from Unisys A15J mainframes across the firmament, soundlessly among the thunderheads and passenger jets as they make their night-long journeys across the oceans and steppes. Nebulae, incandescent frog spawn of information, trembling in the claw of Scorpio, not an instant, then shooting away like an enormous cloud of starlings. Garbage scows move slowly down the estuary. The lights of the airport pulse in morning darkness. Food trucks, propane, tortured hearts. The reticent epistemologist parks, gets out, checks the curb, reparks. Thunder of jets, peristalsis of great capitals. How pretty in her tartan scarf, her ruminative frown, ambiguity and reason locked in a slow, ferocious tango of, if not, why not? Meaty.
It is meaty. So I thought we might just start from the... Start Where It Starts, which is the title. And I was thinking, well, where are the travellers? Are they? I mean, who are the travellers? Where are the travellers? There don't seem to be any travellers in this poem. Maybe the starlings. Mm-hmm. Just the title is quite elusive, isn't it?
It's a quote, I think, from... I'm getting my modernists mixed up. It's either William Carlos Williams or Wallace Stevens. And I think it's the beauties of travel are due to the strange hours travellers keep them, or something like that. Mm. So basically it's about the kind of beauty of travel being the strangeness, just being that, you know, when you're suddenly up in a city at 4 o'clock in the morning, all that, those weird kind of, because you're between places, you're between flights or whatever. And Kleinsaler has kind of talked about how that's how a lot of his poetry kind of comes about, when he's actually outside of, beyond familiarity. So
that kind of betweenness, which you sort of get that, don't you? Because it's hard to situate the where you are, the viewer, in the first couple of stanzas. I mean, who is it who is watching these never-resting markets?
The markets never rest. Always they are somewhere in agitation. Pork bellies, titanium, winter wheat, electromagnetic ether peppered with photons, treasure spewing from Unisys A15J mainframes across the firmament, soundlessly among the thunderheads and passenger jets as they make their night-long journeys across the oceans and steppes. Well, yeah, the viewer in his poem, there's a cinematic quality, which is almost like the fact that the poem itself has a certain sort of one-track zoom-in aspect. So it starts off with this kind of thing about the markets themselves, all this information flying everywhere. You could almost imagine something like that opening shot of The Matrix, when you see all the binary codes and they slowly turn into that actual time clock that's ticking in the factory. But of course, that's kind of... This is more actually you're out in the... right up there, maybe at a great height, where all this information is flying about, maybe from one transmitter across, you know, to another market across the world. Maybe it's off to sort of to Tokyo or somewhere like that, to appear on another screen. So there's all this information, the photons, everything's flying around, this virtual information, and then the poem kind of...
So the information is travelling with that kind of speed that it does through networks, and...
It is, and then it kind of plunges downwards and you get this kind of vista of the town. So you get the... You know, so you've got the thunder jets and all that kind of stuff at first, and then the next moment you have the kind of... In the third verse, I guess, or the third stanza, you start to get the garbage scows, the lights of the airport, the food trucks... And then finally you get the reticent epistemologist. So we've kind of gone through this kind of from the sky, and then we kind of slowly kind of plunge down, and then we finally end up not just, I guess, in some kind of town or city, probably, at an hour, obviously, where not everyone is awake, it feels like that, you know. And then finally you kind of, I mean, the evocation of kind of the garbage scows, I guess, and the lights of the airport. You think of it, just the garbage collection anyway, even though obviously it's boats, but the rubbish collection and the airport, we tend to associate it with kind of odd hours of those times. And then finally we just have this image of the, and it feels like a kind of gag, it kind of feels like a highbrow joke about a reticent epistemologist parking her car.
Ah, so you take the reticent epistemologist to be... the woman who is mentioned in the final verse.
Yes.
Checks the curb.
Yeah, the ambiguity and reason locked in a slow, ferocious tango of if not, why not, I think is kind of mirrored in her parking the car, checking it. And this kind of thing of the randomness of the moving the car, checking it against this rational ideal of where the car should be, the ultimate parking position. Garbage scows move slowly down the estuary. The lights of the airport pulse in morning darkness. Food trucks, propane, tortured hearts. The reticent epistemologist parks, gets out, checks the curb, reparks. Thunder of jets, peristalsis of great capitals.
How pretty, in her tartan scarf, her ruminative frown, ambiguity and reason locked in a slow, ferocious tango of, if not, why not?
So explain that to me again, because that's sort of gone over my head. like the stars and the starlings, yeah, and all of that stuff. Okay, so we have, yeah, okay, so we're with this person, this, mm-hmm, this reticent epistemologist. And the epistemologist is the person who studies the theory of knowledge, what we can know, what do we need to know. Is the poet a kind of reticent epistemologist? Is the poet someone who's sort of struggling with knowledge? I mean, why is there a reticent epistemologist in this poem? I suppose is my question.
I don't know. Maybe it's because Augie fancies smart women or something. I don't know. So I don't know. It's just sort of.
Is her reticence to do with her being an epistemologist, to do with her checking the curb? I mean, I just find it kind of confusing, that particular section of the poem. The reticent epistemologist parks, gets out, checks the curb, reparks. Why do we need to know that she is reticent or that she is an epistemologist? Is the epistemology to do with the checking in some way?
I think it's almost like just a gag. I think it's just a joke. Myself, I just think it's a little type joke at the end of it. I think it's slightly, you know, pathetic. You know, it's slightly kind of deflating the grandness a little bit. I think there's a rhythm to a. You can always that if not why not that slow ferocious tango. It's almost like there's a rhythm to it, and maybe it is just the kind of. It's just almost like a quip. It's almost like a sort of, you know, like a kind of a visual or maybe not visual but a conceptual pun almost with the parking of the car and the kind of idea about knowledge, which is kind of I guess it could be that we kind of blunder into knowledge. I mean, if we're talking about epistemology, part of it is kind of following patterns and sort of preset standards, and then there's the way we kind of blunder into things as well. And maybe the car is kind of that ambiguity and reason, that trade-off. We come to know things because we kind of... So science is that kind of ideal thing between experimentation, but the experimentation sometimes throwing up surprising results, but having the kind of that proposition before the experimentation, that thesis, that hypothesis, that could become theory. So I think, yeah. So I get that idea.
You're parking a car,
yeah.
I suppose the only reason I'm trying to be really, really literal about this is because because the poem is so incredibly abstract. So I kind of almost want to kind of force it into a slightly more literal straitjacket. Mm. Sorry, August. But also I kind of feel, yeah. I mean, so. Parking the car, I mean, obviously, when you're parking a car, you kind of need to know where you are.
Mm-hmm.
You need to know spatially where you are and where you stand. And is knowledge similar in the way that... I mean, you're the man who's read a lot of philosophy. Is it similar in terms of how we understand where we are and what we know?
It could also be, I mean, one of the big epistemological kind of quandaries, like, for instance, consciousness.
Right.
Which is, we have one way of investigating it. You could say there's sort of phenomenology, which is reporting on our first-person experiences. And then there's looking at brains, cognitive science, which is kind of measuring kind of, I don't know, doing experiments based on sometimes on people's first-hand reports, but finding a third-person methodology for processing it. And so consciousness in some ways is a kind of a mystery because... although some people are very adamant that it isn't, and you know, once we figure out everything about the brain, then we've worked out consciousness. But it feels sometimes that there are phenomenological and kind of intuitional aspects of consciousness, but I don't quite know how to kind of apply to a rational formula or a rational framework that feel very real and so on, but they don't quite chime together. And so there's that kind of blundering in that sense.
Mm.
And sometimes with something, someone makes a great kind of theoretical breakthrough, and suddenly something that felt very kind of ambiguous and very kind of intuitive suddenly becomes part of the framework, and it becomes suddenly the kind of something that we can investigate in different ways.
And is that blundering sort of being recreated in the poem? Because I was thinking, particularly where we start off with all of the stuff whizzing around, you know, all the stocks and the money and the assets, and there is this kind of very modern anxiety about this stuff, which is incredibly important, this information, but you know, economies rise and fall on it, and yet it's intangible.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, knowledge in some way, incredibly important information, and yet what is it?
Yeah.
Where is it? Can we touch
markets,
it?
It's real things, but it's a futures market.
Yeah.
So it's kind of, it's so, which aren't real, obviously, you know, futures is speculation. And it is kind of real things, such as real assets, that transubstantiated into kind of ideas and hunches about the future. And then these ideas and hunches themselves, that's how capitalism works, I guess. These ideas, that these real kind of assets have become, these real countable assets have become these kind of uncountable kind of conjectures, which actually derive value. And then these ideas kind of revisit our material world with their effects. So subprime housing markets, for example, collapse an economy. This ultra speculative kind of departure from the reality of the brick and mortar that they're born from suddenly kind of return. They turn into ideas, and these ideas return to the material world to have a definite effect on them.
And I suppose that also happens in the poem in the sense that all of this abstract stuff we do return, whether this person exists or not. For the poet or for us, we do return to an individual and to a word as mundane and yet as human as pretty. I mean, you know, so you've got all this sort of, all the peristalsis of great capitals and capital, and then you've just got this woman in a tartan scarf. I mean, there's something real about her in the end, isn't there?
Yeah.
How pretty in her tartan scarf. Her ruminative frown, ambiguity and reason locked in a slow, ferocious tango of, if not, why not?
Yeah, what does the if not, why not refer to?
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, there's a point. I have to, you know, I like this poem because I like the music of the poem. I like the way that it has a cinematic kind of effect. There's so much imagery. And this is one thing, a point I want to make. It's obvious that you're not... He's written it... I think it's obvious. He's written it not really caring whether people know what a Unisys... I've forgotten the name of it. AJ15... No, A15J. Oh, I made a faux pas there. For a Unisys A15J mainframe is. I think we can kind of guess what it is from the kind of thing about the markets and all that kind of thing. But I don't think it's massively important that we know exactly what it is. There's something about jargonistic language itself which has a certain poetry to it. The words have a certain resistance and a certain texture to them that I think work. I mean, what are they doing? It's technical, it's jargon, it's kind of, you know, I don't know why, but I do prefer the fact that he said, you know, Trezor spewing from him and gives this exact kind of brand, you know, this exact catalogue kind of entry rather than saying kind of, I don't know, monitors.
Shiny screen.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you know, yeah, it's far more interesting that because he's kind of...
It's specific, isn't it? It's got that kind of texture of specificity.
Exactly. Yeah, it's got chewiness to it as well. It's just something about it that kind of slows down the pace of the poem. It kind of almost trips the tongue up while it's saying it and stuff like that. So
I like the fact that your love of the poem is also just one of... you know, something kind of visceral, and I like the language, it makes me smile, that sort of thing. But I find it interesting that someone who has the brain that you have, which strikes me as just an incredible kind of abstract crunching machine. Yeah. That in a way you almost sort of seem a little bit resistant to trying to get to the meaning of the, you know, the certain lines.
I don't think...
Is that not your take on poetry? Is that
I don't think
part of
poets
your...
are these arch people that kind of... I know that I write poetry and I know I'm a mischievous little bastard sometimes and I'll write something but I don't totally understand. And sometimes I write it because I kind of feel that it will send someone on a little goose chase.
Right.
And I giggle archly to myself. Or sometimes it is just it's something I don't understand, or it's something I just kind of find that there's something about the language and I'm just laying down the kind of... So it's not always some big analytical type thing, because if I wanted to write something like that, I would just write it.
No, I'm absolutely with you on that. And I suppose what interests me about poetry, what I love about particularly a poem like this, is... a sort of associative aspect that comes from reading language you don't completely understand. So, for example, you know, the stuff about the nebulae and the claw Scorpio and this incandescent frog spawn of information kind of got me sort of almost free associating an idea that I kind of keep on coming back to is the sense of, you know, information being kind of churned out from the planet. And as we know, radio waves just traveling infinitely, and then someone in a, you know, an incredibly distant galaxy listening to the Archers. I suppose really what I'm interested in is more the sense of those moments for you in the poem. I mean, those moments, those kind of associative moments, certain lines that maybe take you to a place where you don't know if that was at all his intention.
I think it's just sort of those strange hours. It's me having those things, like where I used to head off to work when I was a landscape gardener, and just that thing where you're kind of getting up at the earliest hours and before the sun's come up and heading across the city and just sort of being transported to different places sometimes, and or just when I have been traveling, that kind of thing, when you are in a strange city at a strange time and you're not quite... Everything's a bit more real. Maybe everything's a bit more in its true confused state then.
And you're also able maybe sometimes to catch a glimpse of systems at work, aren't you? You know, the sense of all of this information sort of being sort of, you know, channeled peristaltically, if that's the word, around the globe.
Yeah. It's amazing, actually.
The big picture, in a way.
Yeah, yeah. I like the fact that it's actually a real image of it as a bowel, isn't it? Ultimately.
Yeah.
But it's a sort of... But the big picture of it, yeah, it's certainly about connectedness, that connectedness of everything.
Are there any particular lines that...
I like food trucks, propane, tortured hearts. Because it's kind of... It's almost saying kind of... I mean, there's a viscerality to it anyway, but it kind of goes from these kind of things... You know, food trucks, so we're thinking about a city again, maybe in the morning, these food trucks moving out to make their deliveries, propane, and then tortured hearts. It's kind of, wow, where does that, that's a real curveball. Where does that kind of come from? And it's almost saying something like, is it suddenly insinuating this human aspect? Or is it really saying that these tortured hearts are almost just like another part of this machinery?
Yeah.
You know, so it's kind of, but it's the fact that it's emotive kind of thing just suddenly jumps in. And what's it doing? Is it humanizing what comes before it, or is it dehumanizing that very thing itself? I guess another's just electromagnetic ether peppered with photons. It's just sort of, it's a gorgeous line, and it's full of those kinds of lines. And I just like the resistiveness of a poem. I like the fact that a poem's trying hard. It's not totally wanting to be understood, and so it becomes almost like one of the things in the poem itself. It becomes like these sort of city vistas and these other things which aren't really... it's not a very humanistic poem until it gets to sort of the end. And it is about that kind of mystery and resistiveness to our surroundings, the things that kind of carry on without us knowing about them, like the markets, like the
and like our own bodies, I suppose,
exactly.
Ultimately.
There's a quote by from Daniel Dennett, the sort of materialist philosopher, who says that sort of, which I was thinking of in the shower of all places to think about this, which is not a single cell in your body knows or cares about who you are. And they're these little factories as well, full of these automata that carry out these very complex and sort of complicated transactions. And they're just out on their jobs. They are like these cities full of these trucks just driving about. And and there we are somewhere in between.
Yeah.
You know?
And yet the tortured heart is a kind of knowledge that, as you say, it's a knowledge that's quite different to other forms of knowledge, isn't it? Where does it fit? Where does the tortured heart fit into all of this sort of systematic?
And then maybe it's another gag about the, you know, maybe it feeds back almost into that epistemologist. Maybe it is just the fact that the epistemologist is this highfalutin intellectual who is dealing with the forefront of what we can know and what we can't know. One of the ultimate most difficult things, because it kind of leads almost into that infinite regress. How do we know what we can't know and what can we can know? And how can we know about what we know about what we can't know and so on? But at the same time, it's kind of slightly patronising kind of thing about how she looks pretty in her scarf. And she's maybe maybe struggling to park a car. So maybe it's kind of slightly deflationary as well about sort of intellectuals or whatever. It's ending in that little human note, that awkward human note. But kind of, you know, it seems something about why it's an epistemologist that's struggling to park the car rather than someone who's just been finished a shift at a meatpacking plant, you know. So it seems like an important detail. Yeah.
Well, the awkward human note, the meat packing, I think is the perfect place to wrap up. And what has been quite a marathon and quite heady discussion. But I thank you so much for taking me through it.
Thank you for having me. I don't know. Thank you for allowing me to wax bollocky. So, it's been really good fun.
Cheers.